Welcome to MetaStrategy's Forum on World-Class IT. I'm Peter High, and I'm pleased to welcome Stuart McGuigan to the broadcast. Stuart is the Vice President and Chief Information Officer of Johnson & Johnson. In that role, he has responsibility for shaping the IT strategy and leading the global IT organization. He's responsible for working closely with leaders across Johnson & Johnson to ensure that IT accelerates innovation, delivers against key business performance goals, and helps drive growth initiatives. He's also a member of the Corporate Group Operating Committee. Prior to joining Johnson & Johnson, Stuart was a Chief Information Officer and Senior Vice President for CVS Caremark, the largest pharmacy healthcare provider in the United States. Prior to that, Stuart was Senior Vice President and CIO for Liberty Mutual Insurance Group. Before joining Liberty Mutual, he was Senior Vice President for Information Services for Medco Health Solutions. Stuart has a Bachelor of Arts degree in psychology from Fairfield University and earned a Master of Science and Master of Philosophy degrees in the Cognitive Science program at Yale University. In 2010, he was appointed to the Rhode Island Science and Technology Advisory Council. I recently spoke with Stuart in his office in New Brunswick, New Jersey, and our conversation covered World-Class IT Principle 1, people, as we discussed the methods Stuart has used to evaluate and develop his people, Principle 4, IT and business partnerships, as he spoke about the way in which he engaged his colleagues outside of IT in his first 100 days with Johnson & Johnson, as well as a variety of other topics. The Forum on World-Class IT is brought to you by Red Hat, the world's leading open-source solutions provider. Learn more at redhat.com. Stuart McGuigan, welcome to the Forum on World-Class IT.
Thank you.
Stuart, I thought we'd begin with your role here at Johnson & Johnson. You are, of course, the Chief Information Officer. Can you tell us a bit about what that role entails here at J&J?
So I have global responsibility for IT, and we divide the world of IT into two areas. One, facing off against our different businesses, we have group CIOs who support consumer, support pharma, support medical devices and diagnostics. And then we have two shared services organization, infrastructure, and an application development and support organization, and I have responsibility for those individuals.
Excellent. This is your third role as CIO for multiple major organizations.
Yes.
And so
yes.
You've had a chance to begin within several different organizations and go through that process of learning about the culture, learning about the people, the processes, the technologies, develop your first plan, and so forth. And I wonder, as you have contemplated now multiple times of having your first 100 days, if you will, what has carried across each of those and worked well, and what has been unique opportunity by opportunity?
As I've done this a number of times, I've learned something with each iteration. And I would say, starting out, I thought it was all about the technology. Can we get the right technology with the right applications to meet the right business need? That's important, but that's not sufficient. So the next step really was to think about, you know, what are the business objectives? How do we measure how we're doing, and how do we insert continuous improvement and the right business performance metrics into our delivery of IT? That's a good addition, but at the end of the day, it comes down to the people and understanding the culture you're coming into, where the IT team is and its readiness to embark on its mission, and where your business partners are in the way that they think about IT. To paraphrase a former president, it's the people, stupid.
Each new beginning is in some ways an opportunity to put your fingerprints on a plan. However, obviously with each of your CIO roles, you were not joining a company that was at its founding. You were joining a company that was a going concern, that
right.
had an IT department.
Right.
You had a predecessor in each case. There were existing plans. And I realize each of the cases is a little bit different, but how have you thought about respect for the past versus breaking from it?
I think it's important to acknowledge the progress that's been made in the past. Someone could follow any of us in our jobs and find things that we didn't do. So I think acknowledging and building on the past is important. But in the nature of being a new CIO, you're brought in to do something different. There's a reason why the company is bringing someone in from the outside. So there is always a change agenda to the role. And what you find when you look at previous strategies is the strategy itself is usually pretty sound. The what is right on target. Where we need to improve is on the how. How do we deliver against the strategy? So the initial focus is really more on execution, more on blocking and tackling.
One of the things that's very striking visiting your headquarters here in New Brunswick, New Jersey, is upon entering, you read the credo of the organization. It's made plain for visitor or employee alike. And I know from our past conversations that that was something in your preparation that was very important, understanding that there are some values that the organization holds dear, and in fact, they've been held dear for quite some time. I wonder if you could talk a bit about your own interaction with that as you were preparing for this role.
I had very good coaching about the role of the credo in the company and in the culture. Being someone new, I look at it as one of the best onboarding tools a new leader could possibly have, because it really spells out the values the company has, the way it thinks about its mission in the world. And I encourage anyone reading or listening to this to go online and read it, because it's a very forward-looking document. It was created by a CEO 70 years ago, and it's remarkable how forward-looking the contents are. It all starts with the customer, the people who we create products for, the patients, the doctors, the consumers, and our mission to serve those customers. Second, our responsibility to our employees. And one of my favorite phrases in the credo is the sentence that says, employees must feel free to make suggestions and complaints. And you think about that, because complaints are a form of suggestions, but that ability to put a little passion behind employee opinion is a very important part of the value of the credo and the culture, that we care enough about what we do that we're ready to complain and insist that things get better. The third part of the credo is the communities in which we live and our responsibility to that. And you think 70 years ago, CEO of a large company thinking about the environment and the community, very forward-looking. And then the fourth, just as important, this is a credo about ands, not ors, but that if we do the first three sections right, we take care of customers, we take care of employees, we take care of our environment, then shareholders will benefit. And understanding that and internalizing it, and then as I met people around the company and did town hall meetings, explaining how I heard it was a way of connecting with all the people that I work with, both in IT and in the businesses we support.
That's great. How have you thought about IT's relationship to each of those things? So as you thought about in developing your first plan, obviously a good credo applies across the divisions of the organization. What's IT's role in your mind relative to at least some of the items that you just listed?
So taking that as a foundation, we established some very simple but fundamental principles to drive IT and to help us make progress. The first one is business alignment, and that goes with the first part of the credo, that we absolutely align everything we do with the missions of our businesses. We have 250 operating companies. We're in most of the world. We're serving most of the world's population. Our products range from Splenda, a sweetener, Band-Aids, to knee and hip replacements, sutures, medical devices. We're involved in a lot of aspects of healthcare throughout the world, but that principle of connecting to the customer is fundamental. And our way of connecting to the customer is aligning with our business partners. There's no such thing as an IT project. There are only business projects with IT components. The second one, which is where it's more of a cultural change, and it goes somewhat against human nature, is the principle of transparency. That if what we do is important, that we measure it, and our progress is transparent to all stakeholders at the same time, that we don't rely on escalation. Escalation takes too much time. We measure, and we measure progress, and when we see something go from green to yellow or red, the reaction to management is not, you know, rapidly allocating blame, but bringing new resources and help in order to get whatever it is we're getting done accomplished. Having that business alignment and having that transparency gives us some very powerful tools to drive the next principle, which is innovation. And innovation, we think of innovation with a capital I, think of Apple as an innovator, but the most important innovation that occurs in a company like J&J is innovation with a small I. It's the little things we do day in and day out to improve our delivery of IT and technology services to the organization. And if I think about my 4,000 colleagues around the world in IT, if we can figure out, each of us, a way to get an 11th thing done that week instead of just 10 the week before, we've created 400 FTEs worth of capacity that we didn't have before. So it's a very powerful form of innovation. And the fourth is integrity, which has to be at the heart of everything we do. The integrity of our systems, that our systems are secure, that people's privacy and innovation is protected, but that also that we show up with integrity as individuals. And that anchors the first three principles.
That's a great description. Diving into a couple of those, you talked about innovation and the big I and small I. I really like that distinction. How does innovation bubble up? You mentioned you have 4,000 colleagues in IT around the world, and presumably any of them may have an idea on how to improve things. However, the farther they are from you, the farther they are from their group-level CIO, it may or may not be difficult for that idea to see the light of day. What is that bubbling up process to make sure that ideas, in fact, do see the light of day and are delivered through to fruition?
So this is one of the strengths of the diverse businesses we're in and our decentralized model, which is still a fundamental principle of J&J. And that the way we run our businesses, the way we manage our businesses, we can foster innovation simultaneously across the globe, both at smaller scale, but also at smaller risk. To take advantage of that innovation capability, we want to create an environment where people can share their ideas and share them without fear of criticism, without fear of correction. And so when we look at things like standardization, we try to be very careful that we standardize technologies and processes where being different doesn't make a difference, but otherwise, based on the businesses we're in and our model, we not only support, but we encourage diversity of thought and innovative applications. And because we are, in fact, organized centrally, IT does report up through the IT organization, we have the means for sharing innovations and best practices. We have pretty significant investment in internal communications. We use every vehicle that we possibly can, whether it's video clips or blogs or newsletters, and none of them alone is sufficient. But together, you know, we can provide the information to our employees who may see something going on in Southeast Asia that's relevant to a project in India and share that capability. And that's really the power of innovation at a company like J&J.
I also want to talk to you about this really interesting idea that you mentioned briefly about where somebody sees an issue, don't escalate, but rather go straight to the source of people who might be of assistance to you, because escalation takes too long, as you mentioned. It adds friction to the process, in essence.
Right.
But I think the really interesting point on top of that is the notion of not assigning blame, that in order to foster that kind of behavior, people need to realize that on the other end of their raising their hands, they're not going to be slapped down. And so there really is kind of a reinforcing mechanism to the culture of making that possible. I wonder if you could talk a little bit further about that, as I think that's a relatively unique attribute as far as CIOs and organizations that I've been a part of.
I don't know if it's unique, but it's a very important part of our making progress. And it's something that, being a new leader coming in, you watch very closely. Do your actions follow your words? The reason to have things like dashboards is to see how you're doing, how you're progressing. A culture where people are afraid to report a true status, where you see on your dashboard an ocean of green. You've got one of two problems. One is people don't feel comfortable sharing the true status, which means you can't help them. You can't add value as a manager. Or you have a team of such capable sandbaggers in setting projects that they never even approach the boundaries of a project, which means that you're limiting your capacity. So to really be innovative, to get the most work done that your organization can do, you need to look at a portfolio and push the envelope a little bit. When I talk about transparency, it's that you have in place ahead of time the dashboards, the criteria for putting a project in a yellow status or a red status, so that when it happens, it's not a moral decision on behalf of a project manager. It's a predetermined action that they're going to take, which makes it a lot easier for them to take it. And I will say, having done this a few times, as you pointed out, that's always a journey to get to that level of transparency. The J&J IT team responded more quickly to that opportunity than I've ever seen. So within a short period of time, I saw real statuses. I saw plenty of yellows. And I think the organization was then looking at the IT leadership team to see how we responded. And it was very important that we responded constructively, came with resources they didn't otherwise have, reestablished plans, and made the projects more successful. As the organization can see that's the way we operate, then it becomes self-fulfilling. My goal is that a project manager who puts his or her project into a yellow status is excited to do that because things have been trending in a difficult direction for some time at that point. And now when they put it into yellow status, as they can do officially, they know they're going to get help. And they're going to be more successful for doing that than they would have been if they didn't have that opportunity. That's very powerful in a cultural HNJ.
Indeed. I can certainly understand why. You've mentioned and drawn a distinction between those scenarios where the CIO is joining a department that is in turnaround mode versus one where just some improvements are necessary. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit further about the way in which you approach each of those.
There's different levels of turnaround. You can be in turnaround mode because you've got security issues or you're trying to integrate a complicated merger. And time is of the essence there. In those situations, the business imperative is clear and you've just got to drive to action as quickly as possible. And I'm happy to say that wasn't the case at J&J. But I think technology is changing so quickly and healthcare is changing so quickly that it's not a bad idea to view whatever situation you're in as a turnaround, to create a burning platform so that you have the right energy behind the pace of change. And so if I worry about one thing, it's can we make the necessary changes? Can we develop the necessary technical capabilities fast enough to keep up with a rapidly changing healthcare environment on a global basis? I think we can, but it's something we've got to pay a lot of attention to.
Given the pace of change and just the amount of change that's happening in this industry in particular, what does that mean in terms of the business savviness of the average IT person? For so long, for decades, IT thrived in some ways by virtue of its difference from the rest of the organization. It did complicated things that most of the other people in the organization just didn't understand. Now, as more and more of what was the work of IT is simplified, managed by people outside of the organization, and now, frankly, given the pace of change you've just described, the need for the average IT person to be able to understand and see opportunity almost in concert with those people who are responsible for those areas increases,
right,
one would expect at least. How have you seen the IT leadership and IT positions evolve to become more business-centric?
I think you've hit on a key element of differentiation in IT. And I'm biased, of course, but I think IT leadership jobs are the most challenging ones in business today because technology is moving so quickly. You have to stay up with developments in technology. And because technology projects take time, you're always making bets on what's going to be the appropriate technology to deploy to support the company now and in the future. But to pick the right solutions, you have to have a keen understanding of the business that you're supporting. So you have to keep up with both. If you sit down with a business and IT team and listen to a conversation, people on those teams, difficult to tell which ones are business leaders and which ones are IT leaders because they're both focused on the same objective. The IT members of the team care passionately about the business and what's required and what's needed and what the goals are. And on a good team, our business partners have a fair amount of understanding of what it takes to create good technology and good systems. And so if you listen to them, you'd be hard-pressed to figure out who belongs to which department.
That's a great sign. In terms of strategic planning, yours is a very large organization, as you mentioned. You've got a number of CIOs who report to you who are embedded in the businesses that they're part of around the world. How do you think about your role in terms of planning across that entire multiplicity of areas, multiplicity of leaders? How do you think about the planning process?
It all starts with the business plans. We need to be able to answer a very, very simple question. What do we need to be able to do tomorrow that we can't do today? And forget about technology. Just think about business capabilities. What is it we need to do better? What is it we need to do faster? What is it we need to do at a lower cost? And that's the beginning of the discussion. And as we look across our portfolio of companies and the different countries and parts of the world in which they operate, they're often facing very different challenges. So to impose one flavor of technology, one simplistic technology strategy on all those businesses would be to sub-optimize most of them. So starting out with a very clear understanding of the business objectives that each company has and bringing them forward and then taking the power of the size of J&J and scale to aggregate need and then drive projects across businesses where appropriate, but where it's not appropriate, make sure that the right technology arrives at the right company in the right country at the right time. Skewing too far in either direction is to take away one of the strengths of a company like J&J.
And how do you think about the balance between setting standards and attempting to get as many people as possible to adhere to those, with the natural consequence being lower costs, more efficiencies, less complex web of technology to manage mm-hmm. and aggregate, versus the unique needs of different parts of the business that they're articulating?
So this is where I think IT and IT leadership need to step up. Because if you put yourself in the position of our stakeholders who we're trying to pitch standardization to, what it often sounds like we're doing is saying, you're not going to get what you want. You're not going to get it when you want it. And you may not say this, but they're going to suspect they're going to pay more than they otherwise would have paid for it. But you're going to do it for the good of the company, because somehow we're all going to benefit if you individually take some degree of pain. And I don't know how that math works. And I don't know how I would sell a service that's slower, more expensive, and lower quality. So instead, if you can show that a capability you're developing, whether it's data and analytics or whether it's Salesforce automation or CRM system, that they have options. And one of their options is to take what we've already developed, and we should be able to show that you can get what you need sooner. It's going to be much higher quality because we've been running it for a while and we've had a chance to take most of the bugs out. And because we're sharing the cost over a broader base, it's going to be lower cost. It should be a competitive advantage to be part of the J&J family of companies when it comes to IT. We should be able to deliver things much more quickly, much higher quality, and at a lower unit cost than a company who's competing with us who's trying to operate on a standalone basis. It's a high bar, but when you hit that bar, you're not really selling anymore. You're just showing what you can do, and any rational business decision maker will pick the faster, better, lower cost option every time. But they have to believe that you can deliver it.
You mentioned also that where possible, you said you wouldn't put it this way, but you drive projects across the organization. And the way that I interpret that is there may be an interesting opportunity emerging in one geography or in one business within the organization that has IT implications, as you pointed out, business projects first with IT implications, but then identifying the potential use of that in other parts of the business that have not articulated yet the same need. Is that something that the CIOs identify in collaboration with each other? Here's a need that's emerging from my part of the organization, and others sort of weigh in as to whether or not they're going to kind of join to that as well?
And that's happening more and more. And some of it happens surprisingly easily. So our pharmaceutical group has deployed a CRM solution to help our sales forces launch an unprecedented number of new products, calling on healthcare professionals. When another sector, a consumer business, also has a strategy of calling on healthcare professionals to support its business, they could have written their own RFI, RFP, selected their technology, and done an independent IT project, which probably would have happened a number of years ago. But instead, because we're sharing successes across IT organizations and the CIOs are collaborating more and more, the consumer group picked up the pharma capability and has deployed it. And that was a great example of much faster and better and lower cost because we're sharing it. And now when the device group is looking at their Salesforce needs, they're starting with what do we already have that we know works. And that's a very different starting point. Now, if they determine their needs are sufficiently different, objectively different, we're not going to make them take something that doesn't meet their needs. And knowing that we won't do that is part of the way that we help people entertain the opportunity to use existing technology and existing capabilities. So you really have to honestly have both in order for even standardization to really work in a large organization.
Returning briefly to your first 100 days, you mentioned, of course, the necessity of having metrics in place that to mm-hmm. measure progress or lack thereof. What were some of the things that were on your dashboards in the early stages of your tenure to let you know whether or not progress was being made?
Some of them were very basic. It was a matter of doing them more consistently. So what is the end user experience when they call on our help desk? What is the customer satisfaction? What is our first call resolution rates? And really starting from the value in rather than the operation out. And getting people much more comfortable with being transparent about those statistics, that it's a tool to make what we do better. It's not your report card. It's not your value to the company. So starting with very basic service management statistics, how quickly do we restore service, how are we doing on identifying root cause and problem resolution. So a lot of the very basic operational metrics were things that we deployed more broadly. We've also worked on technology performance monitoring, and every IT group has some form of monitoring. Very often, it's technology-centric. It's looking at a layer of technology in the technology stack. What we're driving toward is end-user or business performance monitoring. And the ultimate measure of our success in deploying technology is when we can match IT performance metrics, how long does it take a transaction to come back on a Monday morning in a call center, with the business performance metrics. And we're a component of that. So it's very clear whether we're hurting or helping overall business performance. And driving that alignment in both the formal metrics that we create, but also in the way we think about managing our businesses and more subjective measures of success was important to establish. I would say that making progress there was almost more of helping the J&J IT group get back to its roots, because at our roots, we are very business focused. And so really enabling the culture to rebound to where I think it is naturally was part of the mission in the first 100 days in the first year.
That's great. Last question I wanted to ask you about is technology trends that particularly excite you. As you look out a year or two or three, what are some things that you're particularly excited to leverage here at J&J?
Data and analytics are a huge part of where I think we have a great opportunity. And this is where our diversity and scale could be a really significant competitive advantage. If you take, for example, a hospital system or a provider system, our ability to understand them as a customer is broader and richer because we're providing pharmaceutical products, we're providing surgery products, we're providing diagnostics. And to get that 360-degree view of the customer is easier for J&J than a more narrowly organized company that's just in one line of business or another. And that diversity also helps us evolve to where we can keep up with healthcare trends that are more and more focusing on outcomes. So what is the value that you're creating for my patient population if you're going to introduce a new pharmaceutical product? Not just what's the advantage of this tablet over the previous one in terms of, you know, dosing or other things that were competitive differentiators, but what does it really do in terms of measurable outcomes for my patients? The fact we provide so many products from so many different areas means we're well positioned to both understand the outcomes and to affect the outcomes and build a broader relationship. I consider that all part of data and analytics, but it's really getting more into a B2B space in healthcare, and our size and diversity is an advantage. I think along with everyone else, we're looking at the advantages of virtual computing embedded in cloud, whether it's software as a service where we've given the whole thing to a partner to manage, or it's infrastructure as a service or storage as a service, and fundamentally changing the way we need to invest and manage IT to much more real-time and variable from capital intensive, I think it is really a game changer. Some companies will get there faster than others, and the ones that do will have a competitive advantage. And so we're looking very closely at that as well.
Well, Stuart McGuigan, thank you so much for joining us in the Forum on World Class IT. It's been a great conversation. Greatly appreciate you sharing some of the insights that have made you successful.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
The Forum on World Class IT would like to thank Red Hat, the world's leading provider of open source solutions, for being our corporate sponsor. Red Hat's business is built on the power of community-driven innovation, and it's this approach that enables customers to meet the demands of today's enterprise and prepare for tomorrow's opportunities. Connect to an ecosystem of innovation and visit redhat.com today to learn more. Listen to a podcast in a series we call MetaStrategy's Forum on World Class IT. If you like what you've heard, please consider reading my book, World Class IT, Why Businesses Succeed When IT Triumphs, published by Josie Bass, a division of Wiley Press, in December of 2009. Both the book and the Forum on World Class IT offer stories from a wide range of top IT leaders relating to MetaStrategy's five principles of world class IT. The five principles are as follows. Principle one is people, and it's really the foundational principle. Without the right people doing the right jobs at the right time, it'll be nearly impossible to achieve excellent performance. The second principle is infrastructure. We like to say that this is the principle that separates proactive organizations from reactive ones. If infrastructure is not reliably performing its tasks, the IT organization will become stuck in reactive mode, consistently fighting fires. If systems and hardware and networks and so on work reliably, then a larger portion of the organization can think about the future. The third principle is project and portfolio management. This is the engine through which new capabilities can be brought to bear on behalf of the company. It is important to ensure that projects are delivered on time, on budget, and on target, and that the portfolio collectively supports the objectives of the business. The fourth principle is IT and business partnerships. It's important that, first and foremost, the different parts of IT, from business analysis to development and QA, through to support and all other aspects of IT, communicate effectively and efficiently. It's equally important, then, that IT develop a partnering relationship with the business that it is a part of. If the three prior principles are done well, then IT should earn a place at the strategy setting table, driving different parts of the business strategy. The fifth and last principle is external partnerships. Outsourcing is becoming a crucial weapon that organizations are employing, and managing these relationships to ensure that value is achieved is critical. In the fourth principle, the organization has learned and contributed to the discussion about what is strategic and what is not. Once that's clear, then it will be easier to determine which aspects of IT might be better managed by external partners or vendors. For more information on these five principles and the sub-principles that are associated with each, please visit our website at www.metastrategy.com, and please share your thoughts and comments by contacting us at feedback@metastrategy.com. And our theme music was written by David Armin. I'm Peter High. Thanks for listening.